good there. Okay, so there is then this important body of research that people like Jim Dunn have made important contributions to that really bring forward three sort of key points about urban social problems and challenges, that these issues and have become more spatially concentrated in their geographic expression, that we've seen across large cities in Canada, the rise of neighborhoods of more pronounced distress, that the causal factors underpinning this kind of poverty are multifaceted, that there's no single sort of stressor that we can point to say, oh, that's the main issue, and therefore, with a variety of sort of intersecting problems, broader kinds of joined up or holistic solutions are really what's required to make progress, and that really, you know, no single actor, level of government, community player, business group has the resources, the networks, or the jurisdiction to kind of do it on their own. And this sort of research, this sort of awareness of the importance of these collaborative approaches has really gathered momentum in other jurisdictions across the advanced industrial world, if you like, the OECD countries. Other federations similar to Canada have done these kind of creative join-ups, the language of multi-level governance, and I've just identified three sort of exemplars of this sort of collaborative work that's focused on particular places and neighborhoods. The United States has a 50-year history dating back to the Lyndon Johnson War on Poverty in the mid-1960s that generated the Model Cities Program, where the federal government, working with the states and community foundations, was doing some really interesting work in ghetto areas in American cities. Australia, in the last decade or so, have put together at the national level, working again with states and municipal governments, this National Social Inclusion Board that has become a focal point for these similar kinds of collaborative strategies that are addressing the problems of particular neighborhoods. And issues related to Indigenous people in Australia. The parallels to Canada there are striking. And the European Union, for a better part of 20 years, has mounted these major kinds of regional and local regeneration projects under the heading of these urban pilot projects that, again, are drawing together the different levels of government with community partners for focused interventions in neighborhoods. So the question then is, Canada not so much. We have had a creative federal system, and many of us will recognize the two M's that have distinguished the sort of creativity and the sort of imaginative policy innovations in Canada related to Medicare and multiculturalism, where we are viewed internationally as a bit of a trendsetter. But on these issues related to the new poverty and its spatial concentration, we're not seen as a leader. In fact, we've been a bit of a laggard. The research on this situation points to a variety of factors in terms of the relationships between federal and provincial governments competing more than collaborating. The fact that local, municipal players have not had a seat at the table in Canada for most of our history on these questions within our federation, and a variety of other factors related to sort of the policy culture of the way we go about addressing these big social questions in the Canadian context. The result has been that we've also been quite notable in our study and in our discussion of these questions. And there are two landmark Senate reports that Canada is renowned for, one in 1972 from David Kroll, Senator David Kroll, that issued a major kind of call for concerted national action on poverty in Canada. And then in 2011, the report Senator Art Eggleton and Hugh Siegel put out called In From the Margins, which is a 300-page, again, major discussion of poverty issues in Canada that I'll talk a little bit more about later. And we have the famous parliamentary resolution from 1989 on eliminating child poverty. And again, there hasn't been the follow-up that we'd have hoped for. And so our track record then, a lot of talk, a lot of study, not that much action really. And this notion that we sort of have a patchwork quilt of one-off interventions on poverty and place-based issues. The federal government's been very active on these short-term, what we call pilot projects in Canada, right from the 1970s through to the mid-decade of the first decade of the 21st century. Some neighborhood-based programs, a little bit of money in a few isolated locales, and not followed up on and institutionalized into a broader national policy strategy. Our provincial governments now, we're seeing some emerging poverty reduction strategies, still not clear whether the funding and the commitments will be there at the provincial level. And then at the municipal and community level, although not engaged in these intergovernmental tables, there's been all kinds of experimentation and innovation in Toronto, the Strong Neighbourhoods Task Force, here in Hamilton, for example, the Anti-Poverty Roundtable, and more broadly, the Vibrant Community Networks, which I know has also been active in Hamilton, but is a pan-Canadian, 16-city, community-based anti-poverty coalition. But what's missing then in the Canadian context is that it's not joined up. The synergies, therefore, are not sort of tapped into. The sum remains less than the parts. And I think Senator Siegel has made a useful kind of summation of what's going on in Canada, in a classic kind of rut here where we're continuing to do the same kinds of limited things and the results aren't there, but we're not able to kind of break through into a new sort of policy framework. Okay, Jim. And this is I want to introduce then this idea that there has been this interesting sort of policy work going on sort of under the radar screen, certainly in Ontario and anywhere outside these cities where the urban development agreements have been up and running, very limited understanding and knowledge of the agreements. But in the course of my research, I had a very nice quotation from a community member in Vancouver who kind of, sort of put it out there that what's needed is this kind of systemic approach where, you know, you're defining a problem, you're naming an agenda, and you're really bringing together the different players for a more concerted thrust, and this has not been our experience so far in Canada. So with the exception, I would argue, of these urban development agreements, so I want to just take you through sort of the what, why, and how of the UDAs, and they are then these five-year agreements, what I call kind of pragmatic deals among the three levels of government, to work together on these kinds of place-based policies that and problems that I know Jim talked about in the first session a month or so ago in this series, and to work with community organizations and local residents in trying to develop solutions. And these urban development agreements are all about coordination, alignment, and collaboration. They're not about constitutional change. They don't involve the amending formula and extended sort of conferences about who will do what. They're not about one level of government moving without consultation with the others. And they're certainly not about focusing on the urban or municipal scale in a way that is basically downloading or offloading services from upper levels onto local actors. So that there's some things that are key and integral to the UDAs and other things that are really not part of the discussion at all. Okay, and so if we think about why, then there are some drivers that underpin the emergence of these agreements in the cities where they've been implemented. Really a growing recognition, if you sort of listen to the conversations in Vancouver and in Winnipeg and in the other cities about these complex problems that will require this sort of systematic approach, that the history of intergovernmental conflict and competition has led to sort of service gaps and program duplication. Community activists on the front line, in some cases with their municipal partners, that are really seeking to bring profile, focus, and resources to these place-based challenges. And in turn, that crises and the recognition of the urgency of the problems in these cities has been a kind of driver or trigger to sort of out of the ordinary collaboration that the UDAs represent. And so in terms of that, if that's sort of the what and the how, or the why, the how these UDAs work, and I say ingenuity in action here, our federal system really being imaginative and creative in the way in which it's trying to tackle these questions, there are sort of six core features to the UDAs. They are embedded in a set of guiding principles around both the process of interaction among the different levels of government that will be shaped by respect, mutual respect, transparency of action, and a commitment to shared accountability. That in turn, the principles will focus on outcomes of innovation, inclusion, and sustainability. These are then embedded or institutionalized or operationalized in what are termed framework agreements that set out in a detailed clause-by-clause way the terms and conditions, the roles and responsibilities of the different parties, which I guess the third point, this is where it really becomes operationalized. They have this quite strategic governance structure that involves these nested planning committees that sort of exist in a sort of vertical relationship one to the other, a policy committee where the mayor, the responsible provincial minister and the federal minister will sit and provide overall leadership of the agreement. A then management committee made up of three civil servants from each of the levels of government. I'm giving you information as we'll move it, as we move forward. This is from the two big agreements in Winnipeg and Vancouver. A civil servant support structure, and then an operational committee where you have street level, you know, sort of close to the ground civil servants working with community partners, and there's typically sort of seven or eight of those people. So three committees working in a kind of vertical partnership, supported by a professional mini secretariat responsible for issues around communication, outreach, and reporting. And in thinking about this structure, what's really important here is that the urban development agreements do not create a new and heavy and complex bureaucracy. They are designed to bring together the different governments in a kind of agile and nimble partnership that can be flexible and sort of adaptive to the particular challenges in the places that they are focusing on in those cities. So the fifth and sixth elements then, the fifth is policy task teams that bring together different community partners with the civil servants, business leaders, to focus on specific revitalization or immigrant settlement projects or social enterprise development, whatever the particular priority might be, assigned to a task team that has got this multifaceted set of actors. And then for the residents at large in these neighborhoods or in these areas, there is a street-level presence for the urban development agreement so that it is accessible to citizens in general that can understand the workings of the agreement, see how their particular challenges might be met through the activities of the agreement structure and its activities. So those six mechanisms common to all of the UDAs. Also common in terms of the how question is very much a focus on asset-based community development. In other words, a guiding philosophy that says that the point here is to really understand and leverage the gifts, skills, and capacities of neighborhoods, not focus on the needs, the problems, or the deficits, so that you're really trying to discover those capabilities that at this point may appear distant or latent, and bring those to the fore. And the kinds of asset mapping activities that the urban development agreements have enabled have, you know, focused on things like the forms of sort of tacit or informal knowledge that exist within these neighborhoods. The direct experience of those who are living with the challenges, a very important input to smart public policy. That there are a series of often informal organizational connections that can be leveraged by the three levels of government to be able to connect people to potential solutions. And in turn to really tap into the aspirations and listen well to the residents in that neighborhood and to design strategies that really reflect those core concerns of people living in these places. So the where then, the urban development agreements unknown to most Ontarians, there have been up and running in six Western Canadian cities dating back to 1981. The key sort of catalyst for the formation of these urban development agreements, although they are community and municipally driven, has been the federal government, and in particular the regional development agencies of the federal government. And in Western Canada, it's called Western Economic Diversification. It's been the catalyst, the convener, the supporter of the network of the UDAs. There are two of these six, two major models, one in Vancouver, one in Winnipeg, and then there have been four others that have emerged in the last few years, but the big ones that are in Vancouver and Winnipeg are the ones that I'll focus more on. There was also an urban development agreement being negotiated in Toronto in 2004 and 2005 around the big revitalization project in Regent Park in downtown Toronto. But that agreement was actually never finalized. It was right to the point of signatures with the three levels of government. The government changed in 2006, and there was a loss of interest in pursuing the urban development agreement. I would also note then that the Vancouver and Winnipeg UDAs have been internationally recognized for their work in innovative sort of social policy problem solving. The model has been exported to other countries. UDA representatives from Vancouver have gone to Chile and to various cities in South America to talk about the structures and workings of the agreement, but as I say, we don't know much about it here in Ontario, which tells us something about the lines of communication within our federal system, I suppose. Okay, so Jim, I want to just go in a little bit more detail here as you think about the potential for a fit here with the Hamilton situation. The Vancouver Agreement, I'll briefly just walk through. The context was Vancouver understanding itself and positioning itself as a world city, but also recognizing that there was a neighborhood truly in crisis in its midst. It's the downtown east side of Vancouver. A neighborhood sort of in the inner city, and it had been the focus of attention of the three levels of government. A total of 25 departments had been active in the downtown east side over 15 or 20 years. 300 community organizations are in the downtown east side, and yet as the late 1990s, a reflection on all of this, there was still some of the highest levels of concentrated poverty in Canada. Crime, substance abuse, the sex trade and the dangers that it posed to particularly to women, all of this still, sort of festering in this part of the city. And so in the late 1990s, the municipal government and a community coalition known as the Four Pillars Anti-Drug Group came together, the municipality working on kind of joining up its activities for more focused and integrated interventions. And this Four Pillars community group came together and came together and said that we need to do something different here for the downtown east side. We can't claim to be a world-class city with this sort of intense social distress in our midst. And so the municipality and the community coalition launched a very ambitious public consultation on the downtown east side's issues. It included a public forum hosted by the mayor, a broader community forum that involved going around to not just in the downtown east side but across the broader Vancouver City region. The Vancouver Sun, a bit like the Hamilton Spectator, played a very active role in including inserts on the profiles and challenges in the downtown east side to try to create that broader public understanding of the issues. There were surveys of public opinion again across the city region about the public openness to trying new approaches to dealing with these questions. And the consensus that came out of these rounds of consultation was that the challenges in this part of the city were beyond the scope and scale of the municipality and community organizations. And in recognition of that understanding, the Vancouver City Council then made the first move, and it requested a tri-level approach to address these issues. And as they passed a resolution, similar to think what's happened with the municipality here in Hamilton, two federal departments in 1999 and 2000 stepped up to the plate and responded to the city's motion. Health Canada, that was very eager to test out its new model of the social determinants of health and try to apply it, if you like, to the circumstances in the downtown east side. And most importantly, the regional development agency known as Western Economic Diversification had the urban development agreement model that it had been working with in Winnipeg for the better part of two decades, and they stepped up as well and offered to lead with the municipality and the Four Pillars Coalition. So, in July 1999, a draft Vancouver Agreement was signed by the three governments, an agreement that the agreement couldn't do everything all at once, so there was clearly a strategic focus then on the downtown east side. And again, this is emphasized in the way in which these UDAs, this is, you know, Canadian Policy Ingenuity, the way in which they are grounded in community understanding and sort of community engagement. A further than 6 months of community consultation on what the Vancouver Agreement ought to include, and equally importantly, how to ensure an ongoing role for community as the agreement worked through its five-year run. So in March, then, the agreement was signed between the three levels of government and also two agencies of the provincial and municipal governments, the Vancouver Health Board and the Vancouver Police Department, sorry, of the municipal government, signed on as well. And what's interesting about the Vancouver Agreement, it was an initially unfunded urban development agreement. There was not new money put on the table except by Western Economic Diversification Canada, the federal RDA. And I keep mentioning this federal RDA because it's going to become important at the end when I talk about Hamilton and what your potential opportunity is here. But the federal RDA put money on the table to enable the partners to come together, to fund a mini secretariat. But there was not new money, a new pot of money that would be available to finance particular projects that the three governments came to identify as priorities. So the emphasis was on, initially on coordination, adapting some of the existing policies and programs that the community consultation had clearly suggested were not working well for people in the downtown east side, related to housing, related to income support, related to policing and so forth. And it was an extraordinary join-up, 44 departments across the three levels. You know, this is a really big table that was drawn together in the Vancouver Agreement. What's also interesting about the agreement and the way in which it gathered momentum, it's fair to say that a kind of story or narrative began to sort of coalesce around the terms of the agreement among the actors. And I would say that this, I call it a narrative, it's more than a vision, which can sort of be things that sort of exist in the ether or something, you know, the vision. No, this was really sort of grounded in the aspirations of the actors themselves and esprit de corps, if you like, that motivated the players, that aligned their activities, and that they could market externally to other players in the region and to other government departments that were going to be important to engage. And the kinds of narrative storylines that population health is the foundation for economic and social development. If people are not secure in their own personal well-being, they can't really get on with, you know, trying to start their own business or go back and do upgrading or think about, you know, revitalizing their housing situation or something. So population health, a key foundation that kind of set the stage. This notion then of revitalization in the downtown east side without displacement, that it became a kind of principle that they would be improving, reinventing the physical space, but in a way that would build in opportunity for the most vulnerable, right? And this became another kind of benchmark and part of the narrative. And then in the spirit of the Vancouver Agreement, this comes through in a lot of the documents, that it was a way of how the different levels of government could think about what were presently sort of, you know, separated programs or policies, but they could think about how, in the spirit of the Vancouver Agreement, they might be able to link up with the provincial initiative if it was a municipal program or a federal to the municipal, that they could begin to think more broadly about the way in which their different efforts could be joined together. So sort of let's move in the spirit of the agreement to see if we can't get what we're doing in our silos right now to be more joined up, right? And so in 2003 then, with some initial success in the first 3 years, the federal and provincial governments invested $10 million each in a dedicated Vancouver Agreement fund, and they mandated the agreement partners, and I should say that given the fiscal way in which fiscal federalism in Canada works, with the Vancouver Agreement, the municipalities were not asked to also contribute. Vancouver was not asked to kick in $10 million. They were making in-kind contributions that really, in a sense, reflected the relative fiscal capacities of the different orders of government. And so that the agreement then, with this $20 million on the table, was mandated to come up with a strategic plan that would allocate these monies to particular priorities, and these are all very place-specific, consistent with place-based policy, but it wouldn't be a stretch, I think, for you to imagine how you might be thinking about revitalizing a particular corridor in one of your neighborhoods in Hamilton. But these were the sorts of priorities that they identified. And I'll just give an example of a couple of the sort of path-breaking projects that the collaboration then generated. Around economic and employment development, the Vancouver partners created a community economic development organization called Building Opportunities with Business that had a community board, that had credit union leadership as well. It became known as Bob in the name was, it was important. People say, yeah, that's Bob. We've been involved with Bob, and they did two really interesting things outside the box that would not have been done without the Vancouver agreements pulling together the different partners. The first of these was around the Olympic and Paralympic development. They negotiated, Bob did, a community benefits agreement for downtown Eastside residences and small businesses to be able to get a piece of this infrastructure spending action, if you like, around jobs and training opportunities. And then equally importantly, and this is a significant economic development legacy of the Vancouver Agreement, something called a social purchasing portal, which was designed to appeal to the developers and to the business more broadly and to the broader public sector, hospitals and schools and so forth, that when they are letting contracts for various kinds of services from, you know, food to, you know, other kinds of supplies, that they would give some kind of, if not preferential treatment, create some kind of opportunities for these fledgling downtown east side micro enterprises to be able to have a piece of that procurement funding. And it proved to be very, very successful. That social purchasing portal is still up and running, and it's a really interesting example. Both of these are really interesting examples of combining economic and social goals in neighborhood revitalization or community development. Jim, before you switch, it's very important to say that this did happen through the Vancouver Agreement. It was able to bring together the resources of the different players. The federal economic development and provincial employment policies were sort of important infrastructural support, and then municipal and community support all through that governance structure negotiated through the UDA to support the social purchasing portal and the community benefits agreements negotiations. So a really nice example. These are specific project deliverables, if you like, that have come out of this collaboration. The second one many of you may have heard of, which was North America's first safe injection site. And in a sense, this safe injection site is the implementation of the Four Pillars Community Coalition's vision of a new approach to substance abuse problems, focusing on harm reduction, prevention, treatment, and enforcement of drug suppliers. But that it involved an opening this supervised injection site, a series of related and broader healthcare clinics that moved in and around the site that were accessible to residents in the downtown east side, and then a very concerted policing strategy to attack the infrastructure of the drug trade in the area. So it wasn't all just the soft stuff. It was also linked to mobilizing the police that were part of the signatory to the Vancouver Agreement to get in there and mobilize resources around the drug trade. And again, what's important here is that the VA, the UDA, facilitated the different players coming to the table with the resources that they, you know, were most able to contribute. So this would require that the federal government give exemptions on criminal code drug legislation, and they did. Health Canada did, in combination with the Department of Justice. The provincial government then kicked in operational funding to run the site and to pay the healthcare workers. And as I say, the Vancouver, the city redeployed through the police board resources to build a safe and orderly environment around the site. So anyway, so the Vancouver Agreement then, there are a series of achievements, and this is all in the evaluation literature that certainly the Hamilton your Hamilton people will want to look at. It's quite revealing that there were some outcomes here, both in terms of general outcomes that could be considered more softer outcomes, and then some hard outcomes as well that were both sort of illustrating the value of this approach, that, you know, in terms of the process, that the behavior of the different levels of government did change. We got beyond the sort of name-calling and the blame game and the competition. There was a concerted cooperative ethos, and there was, a civil servant said, a permission to just take risks. The Vancouver Agreement created a kind of safe space to be able to try new and different things without being, you know, subject to, you know, a hostile response from senior level civil servants or cabinet ministers. Some unexpected public-private partnerships. I mentioned that Bob organization that no one would have dreamed of prior to the signing of the agreement, that was doing this really interesting work with the social purchasing portal and the community benefits agreement. And then around the safe injection site, and this is more broadly the case with the Vancouver Agreement, in terms of the sex trade, there was a whole new understanding among the police and these some of the most vulnerable citizens in the downtown east side in terms of drug users and sex trade workers. And then specific outcomes, the VA, the Secretariat tracks the number of jobs created, the reduction in substance abuse deaths, the crime levels, and then, as I say, more generally, the health and safety of sex trade workers. And of all people, the Auditor General, gosh, when the Auditor General speaks, you know, we do know that people listen. In 2005, you can look it up, Sheila Fraser, none other than, said the Vancouver Agreement is the most promising governance model to meet community needs. So after the first 5 years, there was some very interesting momentum around the Vancouver Agreement. I would just briefly then like to compare the Vancouver, much shorter discussion here, of the Winnipeg Development Agreements. And they're interesting because the Vancouver Agreement, there's been two of them, 2000 to 2010. Winnipeg's been at this since 1981, so a 30-year run, four separate urban development agreements, and it's different in its design and logic than the Vancouver model. It is a big money agreement. The three levels of government actually contributing equally. Across the 30 years, $350 million of public money has gone into these Winnipeg urban development agreements. What's interesting about it is that they have worked in a very strategic way to leverage private and other public sector partners to join in funding projects, so it has leveraged twice its initial investment of public money. The focus on in the Winnipeg Development Agreement, and this may be a more appropriate model for what Hamilton's particular pressure points are, has been on the physical infrastructure of these distressed neighborhoods, and they have created in the inner city two development corporations that are mandated to deal with brownfield conversions and housing projects and so forth, new retail opportunities, and do it through public-private partnerships. So they created in the 1980s these two inner-city development corporations that are still running to this day. And there was less in the Winnipeg Development Agreement. This is a little bit, well, maybe a level of detail, but there was less, unlike the Vancouver Agreement, which really threw the three levels together to work in a kind of truly joined up way. The Winnipeg model has always been slightly different. Each level of government will work only in its core areas of responsibility, but will communicate and talk to one another and will lead in that area and bring the others along. So it's a slightly different model of collaboration in the Winnipeg Development Agreement. The Aboriginal focus has been key. And I really like this quote from the University of Winnipeg professor, because with all of the stuff that we're going on in this Code Red RX series, nobody knows the answer. These are really complex problems. You know, what is the appropriate role for government to play in trying to assist the community partners and so forth? And so this Winnipeg 30-year thing, you know, a way of looking at it is to say that it's been a laboratory. It's been an experiment in trying to sort out, you know, what works and what doesn't in revitalizing inner cities. And I really like that way of thinking about the UDAs as a structure to engage that sort of social learning. And that I think is valuable. Okay, Jim. And then similar to the Vancouver Agreement, the evaluation literature again identifies some general sort of process outcomes and also related to hard deliverables. In terms of the process, the partnerships with the private sector around this leveraging this private money in through these development corporations, The process in Winnipeg, I think, that's really striking is the importance of high-level political leadership. It's great to have the mayor and councillors on site, but you really do need the upper levels, the provincial, and in the case of the UDAs, it's been the federal ministers that have been key. And many of you may remember Lloyd Axworthy, who for the longest time was the only member of parliament. I think there were two starting in 1980 for the Liberal cabinet of Pierre Trudeau, west of Ontario. Lloyd was one of them. And he was the absolute, you know, wizard of those first two Winnipeg development agreements. He flowed the money in. He orchestrated these inner city development corporations. He was, in effect, as I was reading one of the reviews of the agreement, the first Winnipeg agreement, it was very much a deep commitment of a particular politician. And the other note, the other thing that's important to note about the Winnipeg development agreement is that it did over time, as part of this learning process, it started out with what we would call bricks and mortar, building these big, through the development corporations, brownfield revitalization and, you know, sort of physical infrastructure. Over time, it sort of nurtured a community of activists and engaged people on the ground in Winnipeg, so that by the last agreement was signed in 2005, you had community development as being front and center in the last agreement, which is very different from where it started in 1980, which was about kind of building new sort of physical infrastructure. So that's what. And then, as I say, I think we have some specific outcomes there that are interesting. Okay, Jim, so we're moving quickly here towards the Hamilton relevance. The urban development agreements, then, just trying to capture the value adds. This is a very dense slide. My students would hate this kind of PowerPoint. What are you doing, Bradford? We can't read all this. But the idea here is, this is the former city manager of Vancouver, Judy Rogers, and she gave a reflection on what she thought the Vancouver agreement really contributed. And you can see I bolded the things that she mentions, that the intergovernmental understanding was really important, that the length of the commitment, you know, these 5 years, and often renewed, very important, the focus on the need for partnership, a model that really listened to the community, and that allowed the municipality to structure a relationship with the federal government that, you know, without the agreement, those channels of communication are not as open as they might be. The provinces are, you know, sort of jealously guard often their control over the municipalities, and so the conversation was just deepened, if you like, through the UDA, according to the city manager. Okay, Jim. And now, again, some quick thoughts on the success factors and some of the obstacles to putting together a UDA. This notion that you would have a sort of a common accountability platform that all are in and all own this process. That the important feedback loops that it opens up between the front lines of municipal and community players and the big cabinet tables in Ottawa and at the provincial level, that, you know, they've got the three levels, you know, talking to one another. The kind of discussion Jim's made the point, importantly, that, you know, these place-based policies aren't, you know, a panacea, that they have to be linked to some of the broader universal social programs. And that conversation also was occurring through the UDAs. How do you get income support right? How do you get employment policy right? And how does that play out on the ground in the community? The high-level political champions, and in turn, local community champions, the boundary crossers. I know Hamilton's full of such people and such talent. And that you have a way to build early momentum. Okay. And then link the game to those success factors that requires new attitudes and practices from the various players and the government officials, the sort of control freakery, you know, sort of what are you spending it on, and, you know, you report, you know, for every pencil that you buy and all this kind of stuff. And that's really not enabling of this sort of risk-taking and experimentation. Which isn't to say that governments don't have to be accountable for public money. Of course they do, but there are different ways of constructing that relationship. Community organizations have to move beyond sort of an oppositional stance to one of what we call propositional, proposing more constructively things like social purchasing portals rather than, you know, railing against the business community or something like that. That business leaders can move from single to triple bottom line thinking. We need more Jim Dunns that, you know, get beyond the ivory tower to action research and constructively engage these processes. Political leaders changing their attitudes towards the credit culture to a longer, more patient approach. And I think it's important with these agreements, because they were embedded locally, that neighborhood residents then become a part of making their own history, that they're from the sidelines to telling their own story and seeing some of the results. There is also a literature, a research base to say that these UDAs are not, you know, easy, and they don't necessarily, you know, they're not the full answer. And in Canada, we've had some experience. As I said, in 2005, they were set to complete a Regent Park urban development agreement. The old Liberal government that was talking about the New Deal for Cities and Communities was defeated by the Harper government, and there's simply been less interest in these complex collaborations in the last 4 or 5 years. It's very important if you're going to have these line departments. There were 44 departments in the Vancouver Agreement. They tend to all work vertically in their own silos. Someone's got to knock the heads together. And the Auditor General made this point when she was talking about the governance structure. The central agencies, the Prime Minister's Office, the Privy Council Office, Cabinet Office, the Chief Administrative Office in your municipality has to be pushing for these kinds of relationships. That they can lead to, because it's complicated, and you have three together, it can be lead to a lot of meetings. And there's the risk then of sort of stalemate or paralysis if agreements can't be reached. Neither of the two UDAs that I've talked about here have a dispute resolution mechanism, and there's been discussion about the need to build that in at the outset so that when conflicts arise, there's a way in which you can move beyond them. Okay, so now to Hamilton and your moment. And that quote is mine, so I can't say that's the auditor. I can't say that's the Auditor General or anything. I wish I could. But my view is that there's no city in Canada that's more ready and more deserving of a UDA. And I say that because I think the problems are complex in Hamilton. I think that you've done a wonderful job of compiling the database to illustrate and map these problems. The Spectator series has been a champion for carrying the story more broadly across your city region. I think that there are a series of local champions, many I think who are in this room right now, that are emerging as a committed team across sectors, that there has been this asset-based approach to trying to uncover the strengths of these areas of apparent distress. And you have the beginnings of a narrative, and it's a wonderful storyline there about this city being the best place to raise a child in Canada. And so that I would say that, you know, just as I talked about the structures with the Vancouver and Winnipeg arrangements, you know, you can think about some guiding principles. You know, you can mock up what a UDA for Hamilton would look like and try to identify that first focus that will give you some early momentum, sometimes called the low-hanging fruit, you know, in cliche, but what's there that you can work quickly on and demonstrate some progress. And you've got, as I say, the data that's been collected so far is really quite, I think, compelling. Think about some further subsidiary agreements that, on other issues. You've got the networks in place about the local champions. I mean, the roundtables work, the jobs, prosperity, collaboration. I'm sure there are others that I'm missing here. I'm not as familiar with Hamilton as I think I'd like to be, but that. And, you know, there is the Ontario Poverty Reduction Strategy. Now, here's the big opportunity, though. We have now a new regional development agency for Southern Ontario called FedDev Ontario. For the first 30 years, Brian Mulroney created the federal development agencies in 1986, and he created one for Atlantic Canada, Quebec, Northern Ontario, and Western Canada. And he left out Southern Ontario. And that gap was, I think, in some sense, unexpectedly filled by the Harper government in 2009 when they created an agency very similar in design to Western Economic Diversification Canada. And they have allocated a fairly substantial budget to it, $1 billion, with a mandate to do targeted investing in cities and communities in Southern Ontario. Over 5 years then, so, you know, $250 million a year. And there is, it says, in the documents with FedDev that there's additional funding available to support infrastructure and community investments. We don't, you know, it's a general statement, we don't know, but to me that's an opening. So what did you mean by that? And they identify community prosperity and diversification as a priority. Nonprofit organizations like the many that you have doing important work here in Hamilton could be potentially eligible funding partners. And it would seem to me that FedDev, and this would be an example of where Canadian federalism gets really creative, could be doing some field trips to Western Canada to learn from the other RDA about, you know, how they orchestrated these deals, because the conditions in some of our Southern Ontario cities do not look altogether unlike what Winnipeg and Vancouver have been dealing with over the past a few decades. Now, further support for this Senate report that I mentioned to you that just came out, recommendation number 29, and what's important about the Senate report is that it had bipartisan co-chairs. Art Eggleton is a liberal, Hugh Siegel is a conservative, so it's not a political, you know. It has, recommendation 29 was to facilitate support for further urban development agreements among the three levels of government, in concert with community identified leaders and priorities. So there is a discussion at the highest levels. It's too bad it's the Senate and not the House of Commons, but it's still out there. Okay, so my final points here would be in terms of moving forward, that there are both challenges and opportunities. The signals from the federal government are really quite mixed on its appetite for engaging with local communities and working with municipalities in this kind of collaborative way. The Vancouver Agreement and the Winnipeg Development Agreements both came to a conclusion in 2010, and they have not been renewed by the federal government. There's been no instruction to renew them again. At the same time, the throne speech in 2010 proposed a new federal communities agenda, and there is an indication that the Harper government is keen to try to work on and find a place for itself in these complex social challenges. There is, I think, a broadening national anti-poverty coalition that includes the business community and other organizations at the grassroots level. There are other high-level policy inquiries and reports like the Senate one that I just referred to. I would say again, and this, I think Jim has made this point time and again, that things like these place-based structures are not, they're not an elixir. They're not a silver bullet to solve these very complex problems that have been brewing over decades. But they are a piece of the puzzle. And what we know so far from what's gone on in the Western Canadian examples is that they're a good piece of the puzzle, and they can be a constructive contributor. They create that kind of robust platform for planning, targeting, and acting that really does bring together, the range of resources that the Canadian Federation offers on these kinds of urgent social problems. And I would say in closing that 2013, 2014, that there is the renewal of the Canada Health and Social Transfer. Those are very complex and important negotiations around how we will fund and arrange all of our social policy instruments in the Federation. And it seems to me that, it wouldn't be unreasonable to try to draw on some of this experience with the urban development agreements and suggest them as a way to roll out some of the new fiscal arrangements between the federal and provincial governments and to allow for better planning and targeting around these complex problems that are becoming, increasingly localized in their expression and therefore really do have to tap into the insights and the capacities of players on the ground. Okay, thank you very much.
So we're going to have Terry talking.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Do you want this?
Just turn it off. Yeah.